Okay, so thank you for the invitation to be here. It's a pleasure, and it's a pleasure to be in Toronto, and it's a pleasure to be in Field. And I enjoyed very much this week. I learned quite a few new things for me. So what I'm going to describe is a little bit of a tangent to the main topic of this conference. Actually, I'm not sure what is the main topic of this conference, but it's... So there are some polymers. If first passage percolation is polymers, then there are some polymers, but as you will see, it's kind of a side remark to the main body of my talk. The main thing I want to discuss is the Gaussian free field and the discrete Gaussian free field. So let me start with... So I will not write this D for discrete, but this is all I'm going to discuss. No, this is mainly what I'm going to discuss. And in fact, it is defined for any graph. And the setup that I'm going to work on is some discrete graph that you should think of. Eventually, we will work in Z2. I will convince you that this is an interesting case. And in fact, not even in Z2, but in a box Vn, which is the box of size n. In Z2. Okay, so it's just a finite box. And what is a Gaussian free field? So here is our box. We put here zero boundary condition. And the Gaussian free field is just the field such that the density is proportional to e to the minus sum of x, x minus x, y squared for all x neighbor of y up to some normalization constant that I never remember correctly, whether it's 2 or 4 or 1 of those. Okay, so that's the Gaussian free field. And an alternative description of the Gaussian free field is that the covariance matrix can be described in terms of simple random walk. Namely, start a simple random walk on this box, killed on the boundary. So let tau be the killing time, or the hitting of the boundary. And then the green function of the walk is just the expectation starting at x of the sum indicator that xn is y, like that. Probably I should put here a minus tau. Minus 1, because on the boundary it should be 0. And so that's where this constant discrepancy may occur. I don't remember if you need 2 or 1 to get the thing, but up to a constant that doesn't depend on dimension, they are the same. And you can see that simply by the fact that g is the inverse of the Laplacian, and when you open this parenthesis, you see the Laplacian appearing naturally. So that's not a big mystery. It's a little bit surprising at first, if you never did this computation, that this is symmetric in x and y, but it is. So we are we have a definition. Okay. So this is not supposed to go up. Okay. So that's a Gaussian free field. And as you can see, you can define it on essentially on any finite graph, or an infinite graph when you take a box and put zero boundary condition. And what are the questions I want to consider? Well, we can introduce a quantity that I will denote by xn star, which is a maximum over x in the box of x. Okay, so that's the maximum of my field. and I want to understand this random variable. Now, before I go to the main object, let me make two remarks. You could do the same thing in dimension one. Right? So in dimension one, instead of the two-dimensional box, you have a strip of length n, and you have the Gaussian field, which is tied down at both 0 and n. This is my zero boundary conditions. So this, in fact, converges to the Brownian bridge. I hope it's clear what I mean by this statement. We just tie down a sum of IID Gaussian on both sides. So we get a Brownian bridge, and therefore, what this tells us that xn star is square root n. But what is more important for what I'm going to discuss today is that the fluctuations are also of order square root n. Okay? Now, so that's dimension one. What about dimension, higher dimension? So dimension three. So in that case, as many of you know, there is an infinite volume limit. So in fact, the variance of xx goes to a constant, which is finite, independent of the size of the box. So if you fix x and take the box to infinity, the variance goes to a constant, and in fact, the variance of all entries is bounded. And there is a basic inequality for Gaussian processes, which tells us, this is a Borel-Sudakov. Borel-Sudakov tells us that if I have a collection of Gaussian variables, if I have a Gaussian field, x, let's call it phi of x, if this is Gaussian zero mean, then the probability that phi star, so phi star will be the maximum of my field, minus its expectation is greater than delta, this probability decays like e to the minus delta squared divided by the maximum times the universal constant, the maximum of the expected value of px squared. And from this, you easily deduce that the fluctuations of the field in the three-dimensional case are of order one. Okay? So you get that xn star minus e of xn star, the fluctuations are of order one. Okay. Now what happens in dimension two? So in dimension two, when d is two, from this representation, you can see that for points in the bulk, gxx, which is a variance, this is of the order of a constant times log n. Actually, this constant, if you listen carefully to Erwin's talk, it's 2 over pi. 2 over pi, which is equal to 1, as we all know. Not quite well, up to a factor of 2.
No.
I think it is 2 over pi, but okay. But you can check that. I think it is 2 over pi. Yeah, your 2 over pi is this guy squared divided by 2 over pi. That's true. I agree with this statement. But, okay. This is why you get 1 and not 2 over pi. Right. Okay. So in particular, this tells us that Borel-Sudakov will be ineffective in controlling the fluctuations. at least, well, ineffective. It gives you this bound for the variance of the fluctuation. But the goal is actually to prove the following. So here is what I want to convince you at the end of the talk, and I hope to essentially give, well, almost a full proof. So the theorem I want to claim is that for this situation, xn star minus its mean, this sequence is tight. Okay, so fluctuations are of order 1. In fact, one can say more, and you will see what one can say. But a major question that is of interest for me, and you'll see some hints during the talk, what is this random variable looking like? What is the limit law? Okay, so that's the most natural next step, and you will see hints to that later. This is all in dimension 2, because as I explained, in dimension 1 the theorem is false, in dimension 3 the theorem is trivial. Yes? Well, the variance. In 3 dimensions I said that the variance is constant, is order, so the variance goes to a constant. So this gives you immediately a Gaussian bound on the fluctuations of the maximum with the variance, which is a constant. Here the variance is logarithmic, so it gives you nothing. Oh, okay, it gives you logarithmic, an upper bound, which are logarithmic fluctuations, but not better than that. Okay? And in dimension 1, of course, the variance is square root n, and this happens to be the correct answer. Sorry, the variance is n, the fluctuations are square root n, and this happens to be the correct answer. So this inequality is not stupid. It is giving, actually in 3 dimensions it is stupid. Because in 3 dimensions the truth is that this will go to 0. Okay? So it is stupid in 3 dimensions. It's like 3 dimensions looks close to a collection of IID Gaussian. And the fluctuations of those will go to 0, when the number of elements goes to infinity. So this is tight really only in dimension 1. But for the purpose of the talk today, which is to get fluctuations, you could ask in 3 dimensions a rescale thing of that. I expect it not to be too hard, and I expect it to come from extreme value theory. That's essentially it. It looks like IID. So that's what I expect, but I don't know. This I'm not. The scale certainly I expect to get from extreme value theory. I'm not saying anything about limit laws, but the scale I do expect to come from extreme value theory. Okay, so that's the thing. Now, I should say that this theorem has really 2 parts, although now you could combine it into 1. So I'll erase that. There is a first theorem which was proved about 9 months ago. This I will call it theorem A, and this is due to Bolthausen, Birchel, and myself. And this says the following: there exists a deterministic sequence NK. If you were yesterday in the talk of John, you will understand that I like particular deterministic sequences that give weak results. So here is another example. So there is a deterministic sequence NK which goes to infinity, such that xnk star minus the expectation of xnk star is tight. And the proof of this is extremely simple, and I'll give it to you. And then there is a theorem B, and also maybe part of this theorem, if the expectation of x2n star minus the expectation of x n star is bounded by a constant, then you can get rid of the subsequence. So it's true for n without need of taking subsequences. That's part of the argument in that paper. And then there is theorem B, which is due to Murray Bramson and myself, and a few months later. And that theorem essentially says that this condition is true. And therefore, combining the two, you get the tightness of this thing without need for subsequence. I should make a remark that, in fact, the method of proof here, you could, if you wish to, get directly the tightness of fluctuations without going to theorem A. But I think that theorem A, first of all, the proof is very simple. It has wide range applications, in particular to first passage percolation, and I'll tell you something about it in a moment. And it explains what is really going on. But as I said, one could really take the proof here, work with it a little bit, and not use theorem A at all. Okay. So I want to, now I need to give a little bit more in terms of background. So what was known before? So for those who ever worked with a Gaussian free field in two dimensions, they know that somewhere behind there is lurking a tree structure. Now, I don't want to make this sentence precise. You will see several examples of that. But maybe the best example of that is a paper by Bolthausen, Derschel, and Giacomin from about 10 years ago. I think it was 2000, maybe 2001, I'm not sure. And what did they prove? So for simplicity of notation, I'm going throughout to write capital N to be 2 to the power of small n, because dyadic scales will play a role, and also because everything is logarithmic in the dimension anyway. So this is just, it will be convenient, and at the end, if you look at the argument, you realize that it's not important. So what they showed is that if you take, and also, with the risk of confusion, xn star, I will also rewrite as xn star. So I hope that this will not confuse you too much. When I write the lower case, it means really that I took capital N, which is 2 to the small n, and I just write it like that. Okay, so this is just so that I don't get... So I'll try to work all the time with a small n and not a capital N. Okay, so what they showed is that if you take xn star and you divide it by n, this converges to a constant. And it converges, also the expectation converges, it just converges to a constant. And the proof of this result goes through an approximate tree structure. So essentially what they were able to do, or one way to interpret the results, is that inside the Gaussian field you can find an approximate tree structure by thinning the Gaussian field. So by looking not at every point, but by looking only at certain points. And for this one, you can prove something using first and second moments. And I will discuss in the second part of the talk first and second moments. But this is what they did. And the best result after that concerning fluctuations is the result of Shourav Chatterjee, or the best to my knowledge at least, who by using essentially concentration techniques or hyperconductivity, was able to show that the fluctuations of xn are little order of the variance, of the square root of the variance. So he showed that xn star, the variance of xn star minus x expectation, is little order of log n, if I remember correctly. So it's better than what a straightforward application of Borel would give you, but not much better. Yes, thank you.
It's little order of n.
Okay? Maybe, yeah. So you get something from that, but very far from one. Okay, so that's the background. And now let me switch gears and forget for a moment about Gaussian fields and tell you something about branching random walks. So what are branching random walks? So again, for this audience, it is clear. So branching random walks are just a directed polymer. So you take, but on a tree and not on a lattice. So you take the tree and you put on each edge a random variable. So call it WE for each edge. And then for each vertex here, you define S, so if you have a vertex here, SV will be just the sum of WE, E on the geodesic connecting 0 and V. Okay? And then the maximum of that is exactly the quantity that you would be interested in the zero temperature. Okay, but of course it's a tree. It's much simpler than on the lattice. And there is a lot known about branching random walks. And in particular, there are links with KPP and things like that. I will describe it later. But in particular, in the early 90s, so I think 91, Decking and Host came up with a very slick argument that showed that the maximum of the Gaussian free field, of the branching random walk, so of course you define Sn star, so n now is the depth of the tree. You see now the logic for my notation. So capital N is the number of vertices at the bottom, but so capital N is the number of variables, and small n is the depth of the tree. And Decking and Host were able to come up with a slick argument that showed that this are of order 1. And I want to give you their proof and to show how it applies in our situation. So here is our proof. So take a tree of size n plus 1. Okay? Take a tree of size n plus 1. Now we are going to do two different decompositions. The first decomposition, we are going to cut the tree here and write a recursion. So what happens when we cut the tree here? We get the following. We get that x n plus 1 star, or s n plus 1 star, which is obvious notation, the maximum at depth n plus 1, which is here, is equal in distribution to what? To the maximum of Sn star plus W, Sn star prime plus W prime, where these are independent, W and W prime are independent and have the same law as the edge, and that's it. Why is that true? Well, what is the maximum of the partial sums all the way here? Of course, it is a maximum of either going taking the maximum on the left side or on the right side. If you take the maximum on the left side, what is it? It's this random variable plus whatever was the maximum below. What is it on the right side? It's the maximum of this variable plus whatever was the maximum below. Everything is independent. So you get this equation. Okay, and this equality is actually, it's actually not just in law, it's really a pathwise equality. Okay? Okay, now, this has far-reaching consequences. Why? So let's take now Now let me state a small lemma.
Really?
I'm going very slow. Okay, so here is a small lemma. If I have AX, BX, zero mean, independent, then the expectation of AX, A star plus, sorry, A plus B star is greater or equal than the expectation of A star. This has nothing to do with Gaussian. In our original argument, we had the word Gaussian stuck in there, but in fact, it doesn't depend on anything. The proof is trivial. Take the point that maximizes the right-hand side, which is a random variable, right? A random index that makes A star. So A star is A at some random location. And now in the right side, instead of taking the maximum, take this random location. So you'll have the expectation of A at that point, which is the right side. And you'll have the expectation of B at that point, which by independence and zero mean is zero. So you'll get this lemma. Okay? So we are going to so I'll need it later. So keep this in mind. Here I'll use a slightly different trick. I'll take the expectation of Sn and I'll start decomposing. So this is the expectation of the maximum of Sn star, Sn star prime, plus the expectation, it's greater or equal, the expectation of the minimum of W and W prime. I simply wrote the maximum of this thing as the maximum of these two guys plus the minimum of these two guys with a lower bound. Now this is bounded. So this I replace by greater or equal than some constant. Okay? Now comes the main trick, the major trick, which is to say that the maximum of A and B is A plus B plus A minus B over 2. Okay? And if you apply that, what do you get? You get that the expectation of Sn plus 1 star is greater or equal than the expectation of Sn star plus the expectation of Sn star minus Sn star prime over 2 plus C. So let's move everything here. You get that this is greater or equal than that plus C, or minus C, plus some constant. Doesn't matter. It's actually, yeah, this C is negative, right? The expectation of the minimum, if there are zero means, the expectation of the minimum is negative. But it's a constant. I don't care what it is. Okay, now comes the final trick of Deckinghorst. So we decompose here. They dealt with a case, and this is where now I'm describing what they did. So far, everything was quite general. They dealt with a case where WE was bounded by 1. So the random variables are bounded by a constant, a uniform constant. And then they said, well, instead of cutting here, let's cut down here. So what do we get? We get that Sn plus 1 star is less or equal than Sn star plus 1. Right? Because you cannot do more than adding to the maximum here, the maximum that the random variables can get at the bottom. You cannot do better than that. So this means that this difference is bounded in their setup. And you end up with obtaining that the expectation of Sn star minus Sn star prime is bounded by a constant, a new constant. This immediately tells you that Sn star is tight around its median. And in fact, you can use Jensen and show that it is tight around its mean by just averaging over the prime variable. Okay? That's it. That's our proof. Now, what does all that have to do with the Gaussian fit? So before questions about Well, why did it come? Well, I said this is bounded by one. Because this is less than that, take expectations, this difference is bounded by one. So this whole thing is bounded by a constant. Yes? No, they did not. No. They did not, and I don't see how to get it from this method directly, but they did not. Okay, so let me make now the remark about first passage percolation. So, of course, first passage percolation, if you do it on, Z2, we know that the variance is not bounded. For high dimension, as far as I know, there is no result. At least I'm not aware of the result. So, again, bounded edges. But this argument, of course, first passage percolation is just a branching random walk if you do it on a tree. But in fact, with Itai Benjamini, we observed that you can slightly modify this argument. You don't really need a tree. What you really need is, if you have a graph, then you can, if you can find inside this graph two copies of the graph, which are disjoint, okay, they may be connected. So it doesn't need to be a tree. But if inside your original graph you can find two copies of your original graph, not too far from the origin, then you can run the same argument. And in fact, we wrote a short note on that, which has, in the best Itai tradition, hundreds of questions that can keep you busy for all your life, if you like, but which are good, which I think some of them are good questions. As usual, the difficulty is to distinguish which is which, but this I leave to you. But so really, this argument applies to first passage percolation. In particular, if you do first passage percolation on tiling or certain tiling of the hyperbolic plane, you get immediately tightness of the maximum, which, of course, seems quite nice result. Okay? Okay, so that's the lemma. Now, what does all this have to do with the Gaussian free field? So I need this lemma, but I can erase everything up there. So I'm on purpose not using that because I think I'll go down and then people will not see. Okay, so for the Gaussian free field, what you can do is the following. Take your box, divide it like that, and define F so I hope my notation is clear. Okay? So this is just a sigma algebra generated by all the variables on those lines. Okay. So now, we use the Gaussian property. The Gaussian property tells me that I can write xz as the expected value of xz conditioned on f plus an orthogonal thing, plus xz minus the expected value of xz conditioned on f. Okay? Now let's understand these two parts. This first part is a random field which is zero mean. Is zero mean because our original guy was zero mean. And because of Gaussian, it is independent of the second part. Okay? What about the second part? Well, this second part is, so think about it. You condition on that, so what is the field in here? It's a Gaussian free field with zero boundary condition because I subtracted the conditional mean. In the smaller box. Right? If I take Z here, it's another Gaussian free field in a smaller box. By the Markov properties, they are independent. So what does that tell us? That tells us that we can rewrite that as AZ plus, let me write it BZI. And I hope the notation will be clear. I takes four values. This is I equal 1, I equal 2, I equals 3, I equals 4.
Okay?
This is just a bookkeeping device. Okay? So depending on Z, you see a different VZI, depending on whether you are here or here or here or here, and they are all independent. Okay? Great, we are done. Why are we done? Because now we apply the Deckingenhorst trick. So the first thing we do is we apply this lemma. We say that the expectation of x n plus 1, now you see why it's useful to write small n. So you go 1, the small n is now measuring scale. So xn plus 1 star is greater or equal than, so it's equal to the expectation of az plus bz, if you want I star. Okay, this is equality. By the lemma, this is greater or equal than the expectation of bz I star. But what is the expectation of bz I star? It's the expectation equal to the maximum I goes from 1 up to 4 of xn star. Right? Now this, of course, because it's 4 copies, depending on the z, you have 4 copies of the Gaussian free field in different boxes. And well, that's a bad notation, right? It really, what I wanted to emphasize something, but it's really a bad notation. The z determines the I, so I should really write I of z if you want. But right? Because z, if z falls here, then it's my I equal 1 field. If z falls here, it's my I equal 2. And the point is that they are independent because the conditions on the boundary value and we have the Markov property. Okay, of course, this is greater or equal than if you take just 2. Again, the maximum over 2 is certainly smaller than taking over 4. Now apply Deckinghorst. What do Deckinghorst tell me? They tell me that the expectation of xn star minus xn star prime is less or equal than the expectation of xn plus 1 star minus the expectation of xn star. There was no constant added here because we took care of it in the very first step. We said that. So here there was no additional constant. Maybe times 2. Okay? Everybody agree? No, that's not the tree. Why? Where did I use the tree? Here, the only thing I used is a magical formula that the maximum of A and B is A plus B plus A minus B over 2. That's all I used. Didn't use anything. So, sorry? The method. I don't use literally what they did. They did the theorem on the tree with bounded increments. But the idea I used. Okay? So I used their trick, which was really this one at this point, and I get this. Okay, but Bolthausen, Derschel, and Giacomin, they told me something very useful. They told me that the expectation of xn star divided by n converges to a constant. And this inequality actually tells me that the difference is positive. So this means that on a subsequence, the difference must be bounded. Because otherwise, the limit could not be true. So this fact, plus the expectation of xn plus 1 star minus xn star positive, these two facts imply that there exists a deterministic, everything here is deterministic, those are numbers, there is nothing random here. So there exists a sequence nk to infinity, in fact as dense as you wish, So give me an epsilon, I will find a constant such that the following statement is true, such that the expectation of xn plus 1 this thing is bounded by a constant along this. Okay, so I have this on the subsequence, I have that this is bounded by a constant, and I'm done. I have tightness. Okay? So that's a proof. And as I said, this kind of proof works in, I mean, you can now see that it will work in many different situations. So spatial percolation is one example, but you can dream of many other examples where this would work. Okay, so that's the result of Bolthausen, Rachel, and myself. But in fact, you see also that if you bound for me this difference, you're done. I don't need then to use subsequences. If you proved for me that these two things, the difference is bounded, then I'll have tightness without need for going for subsequences. And also, now you also see that the fact that I wrote n to be 2 to the power n, this is what just convenient. What was really used here is that n is even to apply this trick. We didn't need more than that. Questions so far about this part of the talk? Okay, so now I begin my talk. And the question is, how do you prove such a statement about expectation? And what is going on? So I actually plan to have more time for that, so I'll do it faster. And if anybody wants more details, you're welcome to ask me. So now it's part two. How do you prove something about the expectation of the maximum? So again, I'll go back to branching random walks. So for branching random walks, what do we know? So going back to Hammersley, we know that Sn star divided by n goes to a constant. This is just sub additivity. So it goes in many senses, but suppose we don't want to use and we want to identify the constant. So what is the method to do that? So the method to do that is to do a first moment, second moment computation. Namely, we suspect that the maximum will be essentially the same as if I had 2 to the power n independent random variables. So let's call this model 1. Let's call model 0 just the following picture. I have 2 to the power n IID, and they are all normal 0 n. So the marginal distribution is the same. Suppose here I take normal 0, 1 as my W's, and those are IID. How would you find the maximum here? Okay, that's an easy. So what do you do? Simplest thing is you do the following. You define a random variable, which is a sum of the indicator that SV, or maybe I should call it IV. So this will be IV, this will be SV, and then when we move to Gaussian fields, we'll write X. So this is greater than N times C. Okay? And now you check, you compute the expectation of Z. And if the expectation of Z goes to 0, it means that the maximum will be smaller than NC. Right? So you can find an upper bound on the limit, on possible limits. So when what is the expectation of Z? It's 2 to the power N times the probability that SV is greater than nc, and now you apply large deviations, and this is roughly 2 to the n divided by square root n e to the minus nc square over 2. This is what you get. Note the square root n, it will play a role later. So now you can find a c such that this object is roughly 1. What is c going to be? the C that you will find here will be constant minus log n over n. So n times C, the n times C that makes this roughly 1 is going to be n C is going to be nc1 minus c2 and this 2 here is this n to the power 1 half because n to the power 1 half when you raise it up it becomes 1 half times the log and this will compete with this minus guy to create order 1. So trust me, this is an easy computation. You can just open the parentheses and play it. So already at the level of independent random walks, independent random walks, but 2 to the power n of them, you have a logarithmic correction to the mean, and you can compute what it is. But this doesn't prove yet anything, because it's only first moment, it's only an upper bound. What do you need to do? If you want to prove a theorem, well, one trick we teach students, we do the expected value of z squared, we divide by the expected value of z squared, and if this remains bounded, then at least in probability, we are in good shape. Okay, but those are independent variables. You can compute and check that if you take this, c as I wrote there, you get something bounded. Okay, just using independent. So for independent random variables, these techniques give us the whole answer. Okay, and if you want to show then later some kind of more finer results, you can play with it as much as you feel. Okay, what happens when you try to do it on the tree? When you try to do it on the tree, you discover that the second moment blows up. Now, why does the second moment blow up? What is the second moment? When you open this guy and square it, what you will have are terms like the probability that this guy is large and that guy is large. Now, the probability that this guy is large and this guy is large, of course, if you now do a large negation computation, the minimal way of doing it is not to take the typical behavior for this guy and the typical behavior for this guy, but rather lift this point up. The common ancestor, you would make it bigger because the cost you pay for it is smaller. You pay it only once. You don't need to pay it twice. Okay? So the probability to have this guy up and this guy up is not... it's larger than the one you would get if you just said, okay, I'll get this point to be the typical high point, this point to be the typical high point, and this point to be the typical. So this means you are blowing up the second moment by allowing this point to move more than it needs to. Right? So the first moment, if you just write that, the first moment, of course, getting this guy up is more expensive than doing just a straight linear interpolation along this ray. But when you are looking at correlations, it is useful to do that. So it's clear what you need to do to remedy this situation. We need to find an event that will replace this event that will not affect too much the first order term, the first moment, but will reduce the second moment. So there's a trivial event here. Define SV of T. So think of T as being this axis. So SV of T is the value along this ray, the partial sum along this ray up to generation T. And now, instead of defining Z as I defined it here, define it as Z to be the sum of the indicator that SV of T is roughly, or it's greater, than NCT. Which is a typical behavior, or actually I shouldn't say greater, I should say roughly NCT, and SV of N, which is SV, is roughly NC, or is greater than NC. Okay? For all t,
yes.
Thank you. So this is for t between 1 and n. So you ask yourself, under the condition that the endpoint is large, how does the trajectory look like? This we know from large deviation. It looks like a straight line. So we just put in this constraint. It will not cost us much in terms of large deviations. But it reduces variance. So when you do that, you can prove this statement. If you look at the level of precision of Sn star over n, you can prove this statement. However, I want to emphasize one thing, and this was a crucial observation of Bramson in his thesis. So we're talking now 30 years ago. What he observed is that, in fact, you have here an additional, there is a difference between this guy and this guy. Namely, when you look at t, which is intermediate, here you have 2 to the power n guys. Here you have only 2 to the power nt guys. Right? In particular, you have a first moment constraint that tells you that the maximum across this cross section cannot be larger than nct. So it's not that you should be more or less like nct in large deviation scale. You should be roughly like that, but also less than or equal to. There is a one-sided bound that comes from the constraint across this level. I'm cheating here a little bit, but not much. The place I'm cheating is that you need a little bit room here. But it turns out the room you need is only logarithmic and it doesn't change anything. So in fact, you can show that you cannot go at any point along the trajectory more than this nct plus a big constant times log n. Exactly because of first moment computation applied at this level. Okay? So what happens then? When you do the computation of the probability, this 1 over square root n came just from the probability that a random walk needs to land at 0. After you change the measure to get rid of the large deviation exponent, that's really where this 1 over square root n comes from. But what does Bramson tell us? He tells us, no, the random walk is not allowed to be positive. It has to be negative all the way. So what is the probability of that? So we take a random walk, we pin it at, so we ask it to be pinned at n, and to be negative all the way. Answer is, this square root n becomes n to the power 3/2. So that's the probability. And then what he proves in this language is that this is what you get. So Bramson proved, for branching random walk, that in fact the maximum, the expectation of Sn star is nc1 minus 3 over 2c1 log n plus order of 1. And this is essentially doing the argument I told you and erasing the several cheatings that I did along the way related to this log n correction. So this is Bramson. And this is, he has a paper in 78. Okay. So, how is this related at all to the Gaussian free field? By the way, maybe I should take a side thing. What you can ask yourself now, if you think about that thing, is what happens if you start not having a homogeneous tree, but having things that depend on time, etc. And there are some very interesting phenomena that happen, and I have, and my student Ming Fang is in the process of writing them up. In particular, you can get here different constants if you, in a bounded way, you change the profile of the sigma of the variance along the way, and you can even do more exciting things. So, this is just a plug for the work he's doing. Okay. So now, let's go back to the Gaussian free field. First of all, if you do a computation for Gaussian free field, and you take two points that are far away, and you ask how does the covariance look like, you will discover that it has a similar structure than on the tree. So on the tree, typical points, the correlation between typical points is logarithmic in the distance. It's linear on the distance on this tree, which means logarithmic if you think of all vertices somehow being plugged in here. Of course, they are not, but the correlation looks similar. And in fact, there is a very easy way to introduce a branching random walk in here. And here is the way you can introduce it. A Gaussian branching random walk. So divide your square into four. To each one of these squares, attach an independent random variable Gaussian zero mean variance one. Okay? Then divide again. At the next level, attach to each of the squares a Gaussian normal zero one random variable. And go on. Okay? You have n such levels. If capital N is 2 to the n, you have exactly n, small n such levels. And now attach to each point here the value, which is the sum of the Gaussian variables above it. Okay? All the rectangles, all the squares that cover it, you take their Gaussian variable. You got a branching random walk. That's a tree structure, right? You take the dyadic expansion of the numbers here, you get a tree structure, and the variables satisfy this tree structure. Okay? Now, what is the relation between this and branching and Gaussian free field? So there's a little problem. You should see it immediately. In my construction, this guy and this guy are very close in space. So in the Gaussian free field, the correlation is very large. But on the tree, they are very far. Because, and that comes from the fact that you cannot really embed a tree into R2 in an isometric way. Okay? So there's a problem around these points. But of course, A, there are not too many, and B, we feel that, okay, why should the maximum be right here? So who cares about this point? Okay? And in fact, the proof of Bolthaus and Doeschel and Giacomin that I told you can look at it in these lenses by saying, well, let's forget about this point. It's not exactly stated that way, but morally, this is what you are doing. So forget about these points that are causing troubles, and let's look at points that are more typical in terms of correlation, and they're easier to handle. Okay, I'm almost done. But we do want to get the Gaussian free field, and not at an approximate level. We want to get really the Gaussian free field. So in order to get rid of that, what we could do is do the following. At the first level of our construction, instead of taking four squares, let's take all possible squares with their shift and adjust the variance. Okay, so what do I mean by that? So here, for example, I have also this square. And I have also this square, and I have also this square. Attach to each one of them a random variable, and divide the variance of each one by the number of squares above a point in that scale. Okay? So in this case, there are something like n squared over 4 guys. So assign to each square, think of that as a torus, and assign to each square an independent random variable of mean 0 and variance 1 over n squared over 4. Okay? Now this problem disappears. Because this point and this point, even at the large scale, they have a lot of overlap in this square. So what do you get in terms of correlation? If I want to apply now first moment, second moment, the tree structure was not important. What was important was a correlation structure between individual points. And what happens now is that you get a tree structure that looks similar to the tree in the following sense. If you look at two points which are far on the square, this point and this point, there will be an overlap for the squares that are more or less of side like their distance. As soon as the size drops to half the distance, correlation is gone. So you have a situation like here. What do you pay? That above that level, first of all, at the transition, there are small changes, right? Because the correlation is not either zero or one, but the random variable at level on the tree, the random variable at level t that you added to this guy and this guy was the same. Here it is not exactly the same because there will be squares that cover one but not the other. But the point is that when you go to a distance which is much larger than the distance between them, the number of such guys is small. So the contribution is small. And what you can show, first of all, for this moment, for this model, the approach I described here using Bramson's technique works. So that's fact one. And fact two, using some tools from Gaussian processes, you can bound the difference in the maximum between the original Gaussian free field and this modified model. Okay, this is essentially by majorizing measures. The point is that the distance between them, the distance between the maxima is small. And so combining these two tools, you get the second theorem I announced, namely that the expectation is the same one that you would have gotten for branching random walk, and that finishes the proof and my talk. Thank you. Sorry? Well, for yeah. So for branching random walk, we know that it's KPP. And there are too many similarities to ignore here.
KPP for what?
Yeah. The law of the maximum satisfies KPP, at least in the continuous version, which is branching bound in motion. This is McKean 75, and in fact, this is really the model that Bramson considered. Bramson, I should have said a couple of things. I omitted in terms of references. So Bramson dealt with branching bound in motion, although the proof works, that part of the proof works here, but actually you get a limit law from KPP. I should say that the question of tightness for branching random walks in general is non-trivial. There are several approaches to that. And recently, so in particular, there's a paper of Dario Berry and Reed that took Bramson's approach and did it for non-Gaussian variables, where the estimates become much more tricky. And there's a paper of Murray and myself in which we do it by in a more abstract way using recursion. And recently, there has been a very interesting development is that Eli Edikon was able to prove for general branching random walk the existence of a limit law. So it's not exactly KPP, but it has a description in terms of some natural martingales associated to the tree. Now you can begin to dream and think, well, okay, so we know what it is for branching random walk. We know this guy is not so far from branching random walk. There should be a relation. So I'm not saying it's the same process, but it is closely related. But okay, I don't have any results on that, of course. For branching random walk. Yes, but I can't prove it. You have to be slightly, so for branching random walk, another question. So for branching random walk, there is the following structure. You have maxima that came from a very far ancestor, so that they split very far near the top of the tree, and there are these guys which are the mess coming from the very bottom, from your cousins and siblings and all that. That little local structure, I'm not sure is the same. But the one, you know, the basic structure, and there is now a description due to Nicolas Kistler and Argan and Anton Bouvier that made rigorous the statement I just said. That is, okay, the intuitively clear statement, but okay, they made it rigorous. And they talk about a group of guys, which are all these siblings, this family of siblings, and so take the representative, say the maximum of this family. And then you have this process of clans, right? This head of clan for each clan. This one, I very much expect to be the same for the Gaussian field. What? Sorry? They have no reason. I agree. The other have absolutely no reason. The other come really from a true tree structure, which is not true in microscopic details. But the clans, they should absolutely be the same.